This is tape number 3 from the Book of Grace, Ram Dass's program at the Upland Hills Ecological Awareness Center, and it took place on February 15th and 16th, 1997.
We are going to be here now. What an incredible blessing it is for us to have Ram Dass here with us. Some of us have been on retreat Friday night and Saturday. And so this is a continuation of the retreat. This is the part of the retreat where we all open our arms and invite more people to be with us. And for those of us who have been on retreat now, it's a continuation of just exploring this beautiful, graceful territory of kind of meeting others that are sometimes called strangers and realizing they're really brothers and sisters and people that are very closely related. In 1968, before New Dimensions radio program and before Sounds True catalogs and talking books and all those great audio programs that we have now, people would record things that they thought were really astounding and somehow through an alternative network copy them and then copy them again and then copy them again. So by the time I received the tape in 1968, it was probably copied 8 times or so. And in order to hear it, it was necessary for me to put my head down towards the tape recorder and listen carefully to a story that some of you may not know and some of you may know very, very, very well. And the tape was Ram Dass after he had come back from India. So the story had these elements in it that were just absolutely compelling for me. A Harvard professor who is working with Aldous Huxley and Timothy Leary and the frontiers of our minds and the potential of what it is to be a human. And I love that it kind of came from that institution that is regarded as the paragon of educational excellence in North America, Harvard, you know, just saying Harvard. But I love it even more when someone gets kicked out of Harvard. Because a line gets crossed at that point, you know. First it's okay, and then all of a sudden it's not okay any longer. And that's what had happened to Richard Alpert at that time. And then the journey to India and finding a guru and all of the beautiful texture of that story, how it went to just not to being tired and wanting to leave and not wanting to be in the place that he was and then meeting his guru. And actually one of the tapes that I had heard, he had said something like, the difference between a teacher and a guru is a teacher is someone who points the way, a guru is someone who is the way. And then he returns to the East Coast, I imagine, from the Boston area, and begins teaching. Only this time, not under the auspices of Harvard, free completely from the chains of institutions and bureaucracies, able to speak the truth as he experiences it and feels it. And I'm an auditory learner. I don't know, you know, it took a while for us to catch up with the brain-mind research, but we began to discover that people learn differently. Some people learn really well, my brothers, for instance, by just reading and memorizing, and they do great on tests. I got a D in chemistry, so I wasn't one of those people. But some people learn by listening, and I'm one of those. And so I heard this story, and there was something about this story that grabbed me instantly, and I took it so deeply into my heart, it became a part of my life. And for the next 20-some years, I've been on a mission to bring Ram Dass here. And I guess I was pretty persistent because over time, he finally kind of got it and said, you're pretty insistent about this, aren't you? And I said, yeah, I really would love to have you come here and to be a part of what it is that we're doing here in Michigan with the Ecological Awareness Center, with the school. And so he graciously accepted to be here. And I think the most important part of his teaching for me has been to be reaffirmed about stuff that I already knew that was inside of me, but none of my teachers up until that time had ever even hinted that it was okay. On the contrary, almost all of them to a person had made it clear that it wasn't okay to do what Ram Dass does so well, which is to listen to the intuitive heart and to follow a path of truth. And the other piece of his storytelling that was really compelling for me was how vulnerable he was in telling about himself as completely as he possibly could, in the most honest way that he could, and in doing so, allowing me to see parts of myself in that. Now, in the Jungian circles, we call it our shadow side, you know. And how important it is, in order for us to be whole people, to embrace that part of ourselves. And so for these last 28 or 29 years, whatever it's been, I have been one of many people who have listened to Ram Dass and read his books and followed his life as he got involved with the Seva Foundation and has helped to prevent blindness in Nepal and in the south of India, and to help in Guatemala by way of working with the Mayan people there, and to work with people who are dying. And his series on conscious aging, conscious living, conscious dying, was something that we really worked with for a number of years at the Ecological Awareness Center. And now he's looking at aging, and he's looking at this next millennium and what it means and cultural creativity. So people had asked, you know, during the last week or so, what's he going to talk about? And I said something like, you know, even if we would have said talk on such and such a subject, he more than likely is going to talk about what's moving in him at this moment. Because the guy who wrote Be Here Now is not going to be wedded to something that happened a long time ago. So without any further introduction, I want to thank you for being here and for touching our hearts this weekend, and for kind of being living proof that when you hear something or read something and then you meet the person, it's even much, much better than you could have ever imagined, more exquisite in all its dimensions. Because whatever they say about virtual reality, it doesn't even come close to real reality, to being in the presence of someone as kind and open-hearted and as wise as this man, Ram Dass.
I'll just sit up here and glow. Can you all hear me in the back? Well, we are all the creation of Philip's mind to be here in the snow, this beautiful place. It feels very much like palpable grace. But we can just think of it as a Sunday morning service. Philip was talking about the tapes that were copied, and it reminded me of after the Berlin Wall fell, I went to Prague, and I was speaking there, and a woman came up with some pages, typewritten pages, and she said, "This is a copy of your book in Czech." She said, "During the communist regime, we were not allowed to print these books. So one would be stolen in, brought in, smuggled in, and then each of us would copy, make 7 carbon copies, and then they would pass it around and the next person would make 7 carbon copies." And I remember starting to cry because I couldn't imagine that anything I could say would be worth that kind of dedication, love, effort, loving effort. But I realized how hungry we are to keep hearing what we need to hear to go on with our journey. And as many of you know, I often introduce myself as Rent a Mouth. RAM is an acronym for RAM, Rent a Mouth, because I just feel that you hired me, my mouth, to say to you things you already know. And I know you know them because when I say them, you nod. And you couldn't nod if you didn't know them. And if you already know them, what do you need me to say them to you for? So I see the predicament, don't you? But we have to keep saying it to ourselves over and over again. So we're just saying to ourselves things that we need to hear, and then we say, yep, that's right. So don't consider anything I'm going to say be a surprise. In the U.S. News and World Report in November 1996, there was an article by James Fallows, who's the head of the U.S. News and World Report, about President Clinton's second term. Can you all hear now? Yeah. And it ended with this paragraph. Like other second termers, Clinton is now buttressing himself with readings from history, the reforms of the progressive era, the world-making opportunities that followed the Second War. He is embarrassed by the history of his early adulthood, but one 1960s relic should be on his list. The 60s guru, Baba Ram Das, popularized a concept drawn from Zen and Hindu teachings to focus attention on seizing the moment rather than looking ahead. On his wall, in the place once held by triangulation and the economy stupid, Clinton could mount the guru's mantra, "Be here now." Now, first, I assume Mr. Fallows is using the term relic and referring to the phrase "be here now" and not to me. But it seems a little bizarre that the term "be here now" should be a relic. I mean, if any term shouldn't be, that would be it, one would think. How do you make "be here now" into a relic? Webster defines relic as the remains, an object esteemed and venerated because of association with a saint or martyr, something left behind after decay, disintegration, or disappearance, a trace of some outmoded practice, custom, or belief. I meet hundreds of people who say, "You know, your book, Be Here Now, really changed my life." And then after they go through that, they say, "What have you been doing since then?" Then I feel like a relic. That was 25 years ago, in the course of which I published 6 books, done thousands of other things. But what the relic thing has to do partly with the concept of what is called the 60s. Because our society, in its kind of revisionist historicity, has spoken about the 60s in many, many different ways, very often very pejoratively. But I think the 60s, I may have a vested interest in this, but I think the 60s was a very significant turning point in collective consciousness, whether we like it or not. Whether you were for it or against it, doesn't matter. Whether you were threatened by it or delighted by it, doesn't matter. I don't even know how to define what that 60s was. In a way, it was a fertile ground for some quality of freedom for people's consciousness. And they could think thoughts and even act upon them that they had never considered doing before. I mean, the bubbling up of the civil rights movement in the 60s, when it reached the flowering of Martin Luther King and his dream, when the heart of many people said, what pain it's giving us that we are involved in a war in which our brothers are being killed. A war that emotionally and intuitively and morally we don't feel is justifiable for us to be in. And to stand up about that. It was a time when sexual freedom, there was new exploration. It was a time when the kind of vertical, patriarchal, institutional structures that we had felt secure under in our lives started to lose their power a little bit, lose their power. It was the beginning of a shift from us being part of social institutions to acknowledging individuality more. What is it? How can I be creative? What is it I need? What do I want? It was a time when people started to awaken to the fact that there was more reality than what they thought was reality. It was, as I said the other day in the group, when I learned physics in high school, I learned it as if it was absolutely real. And then Einstein came along and he said, it depends on where you stand. He said, it's relatively real. A system is a set of laws within a specific time, space, frame. He was giving us an opening to realize that there were other perspectives than the one we were treating as absolute reality. This was all part of the 60s. I mean, Einstein had worked before that, but these were the kinds of shifts in social consciousness that were being played at the edge of. I was already old then. I mean, the theory of that time, because it was such a youth-oriented thing, was never trust anybody over 30. And I was 30 in 1961, so. It reawakened for people some sense of the spiritual dimension of life after a period of time, which I grew up in which science and philosophical materialism had won in the society because of the incredible power of technology in bringing people surcease from toil and ease of living. I was holding my father's hand as he was dying. I was taking care of him in his last years. And I remember sitting looking at his hand, which now my hand is getting to look like, looking at his hand and thinking that he was born in 1898. And in the course of his life, there was electricity in the homes, there were telephones, the automobile on the streets, there were streets, there was the airplane, there was, and on and on and on it went. And I thought of all of the changes in reality that occurred during his lifetime. The chronicle of the changes in consciousness that were happening and the changes in reassessing of morality was being carried through the land and through the world by the minstrels, by Bob Dylan and the whole emerging rock movement and folk music, folk movement. And there was, at that time, a tremendous idealism. There was a feeling of awakening of a new kind of empowerment of the individual spirit. You could trust your spirit. You didn't, like, when I grew up, children were to be seen and not heard. Those of you that are raising children now know that that theory doesn't work. Or you don't want the results of it. It took me years of analysis to get to the point where I can be heard without feeling like I'm breaking a rule. There was a moment when I, the way I awakened, as most of you know and I've said and Philip said, was in 1961, under the guidance of Tim Leary, I was given the mushrooms, the Tiahuanaco, the flesh of the gods, the Mexican mushrooms used by curanderos. And it opened me to a place in myself that was like my soul, that was very much at home. I felt very released from a tremendous amount of social role identity. And it was a stormy, snowy night in outskirts of Boston, and I had decided to stay at my parents' home. I was a professor at Cambridge, at Harvard, but I decided to stay at my parents' home in Newton because I didn't want to drive when I was under the influence of this dastardly drug. So, and Tim's house was only a few blocks from my parents', so I walked through the snow to my parents' home, and there was a huge drift of snow. And so I got a shovel and I started to shovel a walk because my parents are older and this was a mark of respect as a young man. I should shovel a walk. Well, it was 3:30 in the morning. And so my parents came to the upper window with the look that they had used all of their lives to tell me that I was not doing what was socially appropriate. That look of disgust, which I had learned as a successful player in the game to read so carefully that one look of that and I knew something had to change and it had to be my behavior. So I looked at them looking at me that way and I was feeling so wonderful shoveling the snow. And I liked the myth of the young man shoveling the snow for his parents and it all felt perfectly wonderful. It was a beautiful night. I wasn't disturbing anybody but them and that was their problem. So I looked up at them and I waved. And I went back to shoveling the snow. Now, they had their choice at that moment. This was absolutely unacceptable. They could have opened the window and said, come in here, you damn little fool, it's the middle of the night. But they decided to treat it like, oh, he's drunk, or something like that. Which I mean, that wasn't part of the family myth either, but that was the closest they could get to something that would explain this inappropriate. And they laughed with one another, went back to bed. And I realized at that moment that what had happened to me at that moment was that I had experienced something inside myself that was sufficiently valid so that when I got that feedback, instead of just mechanically accepting it, I could assess it in relation to what I intuitively felt. And I trusted my intuition that it was all right to shovel the snow. And in a way, that was a foreshadowing of my breaking with the way of being in a society where you're constantly looking into other people's eyes saying, am I good? Am I doing it right? Did I do it well? Us using this constant feedback loop, which we reinforce in schools, we reinforce in family. We do this as a socialization process of teaching people to know that they are adequate through each other. Is this too weird, or is that you? And I mean, it led to my being thrown out of Harvard, so they weren't like that too. And I think they were right to throw me out. I mean, I had like come on to a tennis court with football cleats. I mean, you don't play in an institution that is committed to the rational mind and deal with mysticism. It's heresy to say that there is a way of knowing the universe that is other than through the intellectual analytic mind. That is just not part of the intellectual climate of a university. So I don't blame them for throwing me out. And when they threw me out, there was a interesting moment when I was being interviewed by the press, and there were all the television cameras. I was the first faculty member thrown out of Harvard in 6,000 years. And so this was New York Times front page news. And so they were all setting up their cameras, and I came in, and I looked at them, and I looked at their faces and their demeanors. And they all were interviewing the loser. You know, I had taken on Harvard, which in Boston is, and I had worked my whole life to get there, after all. And they were looking at me like a loser, and inside I felt like I had won. And I, being a psychologist, thought to myself, this is psychosis. See, when you think one thing is real, and everybody else thinks it's not, watch out. But the predicament I found was that whatever had happened to me, for good or ill, it had given me a trust in an intuitive knowing that for me to refute at that moment would make my life from then on a certain kind of hypocrisy that I couldn't live with. I couldn't make believe. Somebody comes up to you and says, it's nice that you have those attitudes, but they're wrong. Now, what do? Do you say, okay, they're wrong, and then you don't have them anymore? I mean, that was my predicament. What could I do? These experiences were so deep in me, I could not have them. I couldn't not have them. And I couldn't not honor them, because the only way we know about truth, finally, beyond science and all, is some way that we invest something with it from inside our beings. That's what scientists do with a belief system on which science is based. So for me, the 60s were a moment when I realized I met my soul. I met a soul. And then I saw my soul as incarnated in this form and living out this life. And I went to India and I met my teacher, my guru, and Neem Karoli Baba. What he reflected to me was that what I was intuitively feeling was valid. That we indeed are much more than who we think we are, and that we give ourselves very short shrift because of the way we've been socialized, and that it was possible for a human being to be a more conscious being, and not just a conditioned reactive mechanism. Possible for a human being to be a more conscious being, and not just a conditioned reactive mechanism.